You're listening to Transmission Roundhouse.
Hello and welcome to Queer Ear. I'm Rory Boyle and you're listening to the Transmission Roundhouse podcast that's queer thinking, straight talking, and spills so much piping hot LGBT that your knees are going to be burning by the end of listening to this episode. So, on Queer Ear, we like to shine a light and sometimes throw a little shade on topics that don't get enough mainstream media attention. So, before we delve into this episode's chosen topic, I want to play you a quick snippet of some Vox Pops from New York City Pride in 2019. This audio comes from Asian Crush's YouTube channel, and the video itself is titled, Do You Know These Gay Slang Terms?
So we have some like gay terms. Okay. We want you like to take a guess.
Okay,
so describe the term for me, even though you don't know, just like imagine it. Okay, for example, rice queen.
Rice queen?
Yeah.
Like an Asian drag queen?
Oh, good guess, good guess. Okay.
A rice cream?
Yeah.
Oh. Can I say what I think it is?
Yeah, say it.
No. Nothing actually comes to mind. Do you guys have anything?
A rice queen is someone who's really into like Asians.
Oh!
Okay. So it's a non-Asian man who's attracted to Asian men.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so rice queen is a non-Asian man who's attracted to Asian men.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that makes sense, yeah.
So,
he likes rice.
Yeah.
So, as you can hear, the term rice queen was met with confusion and eventual amusement by the NYC Pride attendees that were interviewed in that clip. Urban Dictionary defines rice queen as a homosexual male of non-Asian descent who is primarily attracted to Asian males. Now, I don't know about you, but it seems painfully obvious to me that rice queen is a highly racist term that the community have somehow allowed to become so normalized it's now part of the everyday queer vernacular. On previous episodes, we've spoken about the effects that racism has had on gay porn, on how it's played into meth use and sexual assault, and also how coming out as someone from a non-white or non-Western culture can be extremely difficult. But on this episode, we're specifically looking at how Asian men are treated on gay dating apps, and how stereotyping and fetishization has become an accepted behavior by an alarming number of queer people. Online profiles stating no Asians, no rice, no curry, or not into rice queens have become the norm on gay apps like Grindr, Scruff, and Jacked. And while there's definitely racism and hostility expressed towards other ethnic minorities online, it seems the hatred shown towards gay Asian men is unparalleled. So I want to find out where this behavior actually comes from and how this language that would be deemed unacceptable by so many people has become extremely normalized within the community. In order to answer those questions and also to show the full scale of this problem across many different regions around the world, I'll be speaking to Wei Hong Seng, a translator and university graduate who wrote his dissertation on the experiences of East Asian gay men on the apps in London. I'll also be speaking to Jean Lim, a writer and researcher who's looked extensively at how these issues affect people in Australia. But first, let's hear from Haran Vijayanathan, the executive director of Toronto's Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention. Haran has been brutally honest about his experiences that have been, well, less than stellar as a queer Asian man on the dating scene in Canada. But before asking him to relive some memories that would leave you more red-faced than Madonna at the 2015 Brit Awards, I wanted his views on where a lot of these racist notions come from.
When you look at the hierarchy of beauty and the closer you are to white, chiseled, very masculine men, that's what translates into the definition of beauty within the gay male culture. And so if you're not a South Asian man who looks that way with light skin and that body and that aesthetic, then there's a lot of hate thrown towards you. There's assumptions made about how we smell. There's assumptions made about what we do in bed. Assumptions just made around who we are as people. We're either over-romanticized or we're just hated. And when you're looking at the hierarchy, and you know, when you look at a lot of gay male popular apps, assumptions are made about body parts, right? And how they might be in bed because Latinos and Black people are so passionate. And so it's just a whole bunch of stereotypes that come together and that contribute to the hatred that, you know, South Asian men face that goes back to sort of popular culture and anime and all those kinds of things that contribute to what assumptions are made of East Asian men. But then there's also hatred thrown towards them on Grindr profiles. You still see language of no rice and no curry. And there's different ways of talking about preference too. And so everyone hides behind the fact that, well, it's a personal preference, but you can communicate that differently and not have to be so hateful about it. And then when you look at Indigenous people, we don't really necessarily hear about them. They're not represented in many popular art forms. Again, unless they look very European, people are not considered to be attractive or worthwhile engaging in any way, whether it be sexual activity only or a relationship and sexual activity. And a lot of it has to deal with the stereotypes and the historical ways people are viewed.
One thing I'm curious about is going back to before the apps reigned supreme, gay men had to literally cruise the streets to meet other gay men, or perhaps they were using phone lines that don't really exist anymore, or there were other websites in the past before the apps came along. Was all of that vitriol and racism present in those scenarios, or is it something that's been aided by the apps?
When you can hide behind a screen, the true colors of individuals show up because you don't have to deal with it in person. So with the old ways of cruising, that existed. However, people were a bit more polite about it. It wasn't as overt and as blatant as it is now. And when you look at bathhouses and places like that, people are ignored and shunned. And so it's the microaggressions that show up. But everything is so instant now with these apps. People don't stop to think about what they're saying and how they're saying it and if it's going to be hurtful or not.
Of course. And I mean, I think that point about how everything is so instant now and we all have that kind of thank you next mentality where you can just swipe to the next person. That sort of has manifested in society for lots of different groups within the gay community. And it's obviously hugely problematic. You've been very open about how you've gone on certain dates or had experiences with certain men where they've said things that were, let's say, not so kosher. I'll let you define exactly what happened. Can you give us an example of maybe some of the language you've heard on a bad date?
For sure. So, I mean, and this is not even a bad date. I was dating somebody and the fetishization of me, it was quite apparent, but I was able to look past it. But it became a little bit more intolerant when they basically lifted up my sleeve and said that they like the darker part of my skin and not the lighter part of my skin. I think that was the way they were complimenting, but I'm like, I'm not chicken. Okay. You know, whether you could say that you like the dark part or light part of me. If people actually stop to think about what they're saying, it actually is quite hurtful. Some of my folks who access our services at ASAP or other organizations that I've worked at, who basically have said things like, well, I wanted to take that magic carpet for a ride, or, you know, I've not had sex with someone with a turban, or I want to unwind that turban. Things that they think are sexy and might be playful and jolly when they really aren't. They're just inappropriate, right? When there's marginalized or racialized communities involved and acknowledging the history of oppression that exists. The reverse of that happens as well when we're looking at internalized racism, where folks have actually just only preferred white people and have actually turned around and been engaging in discriminatory behavior against other people of their races or other races in total, because it brings them closer to whiteness by dating someone who's white.
I am cringing so hard. It's awkward to even hear it. So I can't imagine being in that scenario and having that said to you. I know something else you've heard is you are different from the other South Asian men. You seem to have it together. There's no drama. What do you think people mean by that when they say it?
Well, I think people don't look at people's different life experiences. And so I think the fact that they even had to say that I don't behave like other South Asians, that means I've westernized myself to the point that I understand Western culture and that I participate in Western culture and I get my stuff together. I might appear to have my shit together, but I really may not.
Being so open and honest about negative experiences on the gay dating scene can't be easy. I mean, if I were to sit down and write a book on that topic tomorrow, it'd probably be bigger than Kanye's ego and thicker than Matt Hancock. But when there's racism involved, it just takes these issues to a whole other level, and thankfully, I don't have any real experiences of that. Haran, however, obviously has a lot to say on these issues based on his own personal interactions, and he does invaluable work by leading one of the few organizations dedicated to queer South Asians in North America. But what do we know about Asian men who aren't from the South and are facing similar discrimination?
I looked at the previous researches, and they mainly focus on Black or South Asian gay men in Western societies, and I thought that East Asian part was missing out.
That's Wei Hong Seng. He's a recent graduate who wrote a university dissertation titled No Asians Please, Only for Asians: Experiences of East Asian Gay Newcomers on Grindr and Jacked in London. So using Wei Hong's research and unique perspective on this issue when specifically looking at East Asian men, I wanted Wei Hong to define the main issues East Asian men face.
So as I mentioned in my dissertation, there are two main points. One is anti-Asian xenophobia, racist conversations, or just racist text. And the other one is objectification and stereotypical fantasy. I was shocked reading those profiles when I was collecting my materials on both Grindr and Jacked. So there were lines like, no Asians please, only into white guys. I don't call this racism, but just my personal preference. And some even say like, I don't eat rice, I don't eat curry. I interviewed 10 East Asian gay men who were living in London. When they started a conversation with some random people online, they would get like, oh, Asians stay away, only white, no Asians and skinny boys. These things just made people who just come to another country or new society feel very uncomfortable and disgusted and unwelcome. That's how a lot of East Asian people feel and what they encounter.
Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine how uncomfortable that would make somebody feel hearing those terms. And one thing that we're trying to get to the bottom of on this podcast is where these sort of phrases come from, such as no rice, no curry, or even in your writing, you speak a bit about Orientalism. It's very clear that you want to see positive change. What are some of the key points you want people to take away from the research that you've done?
I think it's important that people know that this kind of things happen, really happen. Anti-Asian xenophobia and stereotypical fantasy as discrimination. I looked into 1,400 Grindr and Jacked profiles in 2017 in the Greater London area. 10% featured content related to discrimination and fetishism of Asian men. I just want people to know that these things happen, and it would be nice if all of the people in the world can put themselves into other people's shoes. Our community is long being oppressed by other people. And it just doesn't make sense to me that within our community, how can they be racist when they are a member of an oppressed minority?
And then final question to you is about the fact that now some of these apps, including Grindr, have removed race filters. Do you think that that is going to actually elicit change, or do you think it seems more kind of like ticking a box in order to come across as actually being progressive?
I think both. But I think it's a positive step of one of the biggest dating apps in the world to do that. I just think slowly, if all the dating apps remove ethnicity filters or these kind of features in the future, people will slowly care less on that characteristic, on the racial characteristic. I just think this kind of thing needs time for people to change because it's a very rooted notion in some minds.
So I'm not going to lie, this issue is definitely an important one to cover, but it's also really sad hearing some of these stories. And I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of some of the men who've had to experience this prejudice. It must be pretty bleak. Gene Lim is a PhD candidate based in Melbourne, and his expertise lies in research on ethnic minority and LGBTQ groups. He recently contributed to an article for The Conversation, which discussed a lot of the issues we're speaking about today and highlighted the impact of this racism in Australia. One thing I'm finding really hard to process is the hatred towards queer people from those in their own community. So I had to start by asking Jean if part of the problem is white gay men still holding so many of the cards, and then that privilege presenting itself in racist arrogance.
I think it has more to do with a sort of solipsism amongst gay men. This utter infatuation with their own image to some extent. I mean, have you just opened someone's Instagram and it's just almost masturbatory and sort of self-obsessed kind of perspective to oneself. And I think that reflects in things like body shape, body size, race, ability, things like that. I think it also comes down to being privileged enough not to see yourself as anything but the default. I say that because that's not just white men that are like that, right? So I have a friend who's also from Singapore as I am. So I was born in Singapore. He's recently published a really good paper investigating how Chinese men in Singapore, who are the racial majority, treat Malay and Indian men. Newsflash, it's pretty much the same thing. They have cultural dominance, political dominance that reflects itself in taste, right? Sexual taste, it reflects itself in who you surround yourself with, who you sleep with and who you go home with at the end of the day, right? It also reflects in how you treat other people in a way. It really comes down, I think, to this very fundamental in-group, out-group mentality, right? Where you see everyone who's not like you and who isn't part of your group as almost subhuman. And it sounds a bit hyperbolic. I've spoken to so many gay men, you know, and they tell me time and time again that I think the one thing that really gets them is that sort of palpable sense of disgust that a lot of gay white men seem to harbor towards them. It's not even aversion. It's not even like they're scared or they're sort of, they don't understand. It's just disgust, right? Like literally had one person talk about this time that they went to a gay bar and they approached a white man who was sitting at a table with a bunch of empty chairs. And he was going to ask for one of the chairs because his group didn't have enough chairs at their table. Immediately he just spins around and tells him, oh, you know, I'm not into agents, sorry.
Wow.
Yeah, and that is the perfect metaphor for that, isn't it? The perfect metaphor for how Asian people are sidelined by not being considered attractive. It doesn't matter if you don't want to fuck someone. You probably should still treat them as a person.
I do think that swiping right and swiping left and blocking and sliding into someone's DMs, it's definitely dehumanized a lot of our interactions. One thing I'm really interested in as well is I know you've clearly done a lot of research and a lot of interaction right. with different gay
yes,
men.
I have.
Yeah, I'm sure. But tell me a little bit about maybe some experiences that queer Asian women might face, because I've definitely read articles and definitely seen things online about the stereotyping of Asian women in general. But is there anything specific that queer Asian women face that's different to men?
So obviously, if you're talking about queer women, their experiences are going to range from fetishization to rejection on the basis of their ethnicity. For lesbian Asian women, I think a lot of them do face the same kinds of challenges that Asian men face. They're not considered as viable partners by their white counterparts, you know, by the racial majority. I know we keep talking about the racial majority, but I think it's important to note that it's not just the racial majority. This represents a very dominant view. It's something that gets internalized, even by other minority persons. And I think that's the most insidious part of it. If this person doesn't want to engage me on the basis that we're culturally dissimilar, whatever, you know, I can't really do anything about that. But then when it's someone from my own culture and someone who looks like me and someone's the same skin color as me, but they're so averse to the sheer notion of even being seen with someone like me, you know, that's a whole different level of heartbreaking.
Tell me specifically about the impact that all of the above is having on the community in Australia.
If all you're told is that XYZ looks attractive, XYZ is attractive, XYZ is fuckable, it becomes very hard to see anything else as attractive or fuckable. It's sexual self-socialization. When you enforce that erotic response, it's always the same sort of cis, white, muscled, able-bodied men. In Melbourne, we used to have Asian bars where they would have nights specifically for Black folks or Asian folks or Latin folks. Now there's nothing like that anymore. It's just all been whittled down to this one sort of establishment that's meant to cater to one demographic. Everyone else can just get fucked, I guess. But that's sort of what the impact is. You won't believe the kind of things that gay Asian men will say about people like them, you know? It's just like self-hatred. It's really distressing. You can sort of palpably see the pain that they're in to be able to make the comments that they make about people that look like them, who are like them, who basically have similar backgrounds to them.
So Jean went on to repeat some of the racist phrases and slang that we've heard continuously throughout this episode, and he also described how many Asian men have a desire to meet a white partner, and this is often valued over a relationship with someone of any other ethnicity. This all feels really toxic to me, and not in the good Britney kind of way. So I want to move the conversation forward to how we can establish real change in order to stop this insane level of racism. But before Jean went into exactly how we can manage that, he found the time to throw a little shade at Disney.
Have you subscribed to, say, that new Disney streaming service when you see them try to be woke, but at the same time, they're still like a massive corporation that mistreats its workers and tokenizes minorities? There needs to be material change as well as symbolic change. I think we need to develop more empathy. Emotions almost have a life of their own when it comes to things like race and racial prejudice. When someone eyes, say, an immigrant across the street really warily, they're not thinking, oh, he's going to steal my job. Or, you know, he's going to make my children's futures that much dimmer. What they feel in that moment is this very visceral sort of revulsion and aversion. Emotional response is something that props up racism. It means that you're too afraid to engage. It means that by being too afraid to engage, you're never challenged on the validity of your views and your opinion. This is really succinctly illustrated in America with stuff about anti-Black racism. How much of that has involved these emotions of fear, of disgust, and even occasionally of desire? Like if you think about marriage equality in the West, for example, what was the big sea change? The big sea change was to get people to empathize with gay couples, to consider, wait, how would you feel if your relationships, if your sexual preferences for one gender or the other was criminalized? It was getting people to empathize and to feel that injustice and that pain that, you know, a lot of minority persons feel on an everyday basis. And I think on that point, we've made some really good progress. And I really don't want to make it out as a white versus everyone else kind of problem. I think this is an issue that has to do with humanity, unfortunately. It's like recognizing the humanity of someone else. This legal scholar that I cite a lot in a lot of my works says it best, you know, that intimacy is as much of a human right as anything else. The opportunity to pursue intimacy is a human right. But things like sexual racism really stops that from happening. It's an issue of justice, I feel.
So without trying to make this a white versus everyone else issue, I think one thing I've learned over the course of this episode and throughout making this podcast in general is that when we look at where we are right now in terms of our world leaders, the great political divide in many different places, and global racial injustice, there's still so much work to be done in order to see tangible change when it comes to how racism plays out in society and more specifically on dating apps. I think looking back at our episode on the gay panic defense, it became abundantly clear to me that a lot of the tension in society at the moment is coming from the top down. And frankly, one of the big steps is electing world leaders who aren't racist and actually want to see real progress in terms of anti-racism. Now, one thing that is encouraging is there's been many articles on mainstream platforms such as Slate, Glamour, BBC, and Forbes all in recent months, and all of these articles are beginning to tackle some of the issues raised in this episode. But in my humble opinion, Grindr removing their race filters is a baby step in the long road ahead. So do me a favour. The next time you're on your favourite dating app, take a second to really think about the person you're interacting with. Take the time to consider their feelings, their emotions, and the language that you're using. Because, as Cheryl once sang, we're only human. Oh, and while you've got your phone in your hand, please do rate us 5 stars or leave us a review on Apple or follow us on Spotify or your favourite streaming service. All right, I think that's enough of me dictating what you do in your spare time for one episode. So all that's left to say is I'm Rory Boyle, and thank you for getting it in gear, keeping it here, and listening to Queer Ear.
You're listening to Transmission Roundtable.